go up on the city.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, I'm going to get this next panel started. This next panel is really the topic is financing projects with the existing state programs. My name is Jeff Brown, president of USA Properties Fund, and I'm the moderator for this panel. And really, like I said, the goal of this panel is to explore ways how we can better improve our housing production with our existing state programs. Currently, I think none of us would, I think, disagree that we need more affordable housing in California. I think the vacancy rate statewide is plus or minus 2%. And one of the big challenges we have with our affordable housing current state programs in place, partially as a result of the redevelopment going away for whatever other reasons you want to conclude. But we have over $5 billion of unused bond capacity in California. And that seems to be a resource we don't seem to be as effectively able to tap into, either whether that's to create new production or preserve the existing stock of affordable housing. And so our panel here today is going to discuss ideas and ways that maybe we can address that problem, both as a result of doing regulatory changes as well as exploring what could we get from the state that we don't have that would also help alleviate this problem so we could get more units on the ground, more jobs created, and preserve our existing stock. The panel we have here today is Justin Cooper. He's a bond counsel with Orrick Herrington, and they're probably the largest bond counsel of bond deals statewide. Caleb Roop, who's developer statewide as well. The Pacific Companies is his company, and he's going to specifically get into the minutiae of this a little bit. Justin's going to give more of a cursory overview of the problem. The next panelist we have is Jonathan Klein of Union Bank. Union Bank is both a lender and investor of affordable housing statewide, and he's going to share from the lender's perspective what this challenge looks like and share his thoughts on how we can improve. And finally, we have Tia Bo Patterson. She's the new executive director of the California Housing Finance Agency, and she's going to share her perspective relative to, as a state agency, maybe what can be done with the program, the departments to work together. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Justin Cooper.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. So as bond counsel, I see a fairly unique slice, or we see a unique slice of the market. It's very, very wide, but also very thin. You know, I don't see deals that much in the initial stages, don't often see what happens to them afterwards, only really see the bond deals, not the 9% deals. So bear in mind, please, that everything I'm saying is just from my admittedly somewhat narrow or thin perspective. Just to put some numbers on what Jeff was describing and the volume cap point, let's imagine a project that's got a $9 million cost. And so to meet the 50% test with a little bit of cushion, you'd need, what, $5 million in tax-exempt bonds, right? And I think it's fair to say that on a $9 million project, if 4% credits usually pay for between 25 and 30% of a project cost, you could guess, it might be a little high, that the tax credits would pay for about $2.5 million. So if you run all that through your head, what you end up with is every dollar of volume cap of which we have 6 billion, something like that. We turned back a couple billion last year. In a sense, is worth, to the extent it can be applied to multifamily housing, 50 cents of 4% tax credits, which are a direct subsidy of the United States Treasury into the state of California. So as a colleague of mine put it acerbically in reference to what's going on with our volume cap, it's the equivalent of having a Brinks armored truck full of money show up at the Nevada-California border and turning it around and sending it back to Washington. We are actually sending back billions of dollars. There are lots of reasons for that, and I don't know what all those reasons are, but the fact is that we are foregoing a large amount of direct subsidy in the form of 4% tax credits, subsidy that represents both affordable housing and economic stimulus in the form of jobs, construction jobs, many of which are union jobs. So that's the perspective I see, and I hear people call all the time, people call me all the time with deals that they want to do as bond deals, and they're not working as bond deals, and I'll leave it to Caleb and others and Jonathan and Jeff to explain exactly why certain deals aren't working as bond deals. I certainly don't think that we could blow the full $6 billion out on bond deals. I don't think there are that many bond deals out there that would work as you know, 4% credits in bond deals. I'm not qualified to know that, but it seems unlikely to me. But there's a general sense that I get from across the development community that there are bond deals out there that could work with some changes that are not currently working. And specifically, just to narrow in on one point, the kind that I hear about the most, or one of the ones I hear about the most, is 80-20 deals. I probably once a month, if not twice a month, have a conversation where someone calls me up, market rate developer, they say, you know, I want to do an 80-20 deal. Can you walk me through the tax-exempt bond rules? I do that. Can you walk me through all the other requirements? Sure. What about, you know, we go through the state law, everything like that. They say, that all sounds fine. They say, what are the SIDLAC requirements? I tell them about the SIDLAC requirements. They say, yeah, that all sounds more or less okay. How long does the regulatory agreement have to be in place? 55 years. And they say, oh, well, it's been nice talking to you. I'm going to go do a market rate deal. And there it goes. And the current SIDLAC rule is that it's a 55-year regulatory agreement if we're in a non-competitive round, a 30-year regulatory agreement if we're in a competitive round, which we haven't had since 2006, 2007, something like that. So I'm really just sort of the messenger here for what I hear from developers. They're frustrated in particular on 80-20 deals, and generally they are frustrated that the TCAC and SIDLAC regulations are aligned or work together in such a way as to, they believe, to make it difficult to do 4% credit deals with tax-exempt bonds.
Thank you, Justin. Caleb Roop is now going to kind of walk us through some ideas of how maybe we can modify our regulations, as well as suggestions for state programs where we can attract more capital to bond deals to make them more economically feasible. Caleb?
Good afternoon, everybody. Hopefully you can hear me okay. Thanks for having me. My whole purpose here is relatively laser focused. I'm going to go into the 4% program as it exists today. We're going to talk about the production levels, and then we're going to spend some time talking about how we might change that. That's really fundamentally what we're after. And at the end of this, what I'm really after is I'm after every one of you in the audience, agreeing with or accepting some portion of these interpretations, and then getting behind them when it's time for policy changes to be made at SIDLAC and at TCAC in particular, and in the future, potentially legislatively. Okay? So that's what I'm after. I'm going to talk about historical production, current regulation changes that will be useful, state tax credit program changes legislatively, as well as programmatic, some other ideas to drive production in the program, and then a real question I'm going to leave you all with to consider for yourselves. So this is public data. You can find this on TCAC's website. We had to do a little research to get the specifics, but the historical production in the 4% tax credit SIDLAC bond program was about 6,000 units from 2000 to 2008. And I kind of used that cutoff of 2008 because that was really when the real estate collapse occurred. Now, current production through the past 5 years, call it, is about 3,200 units since 2008. And that does include a meaningful impact from the stimulus funding, the American Reinvestment Recovery Act of 2009. So it's skewed that way upward. 2013 saw a production of about 2,400 units, and 2014 year-to-date is about 1,880 units, on its way to maybe somewhere in the 2,400 unit range. Sort of depends on what applications come in the rest of the year. Very low, very depressed. This is just a graphical depiction of all that. You can kind of see the production fall. You see in the later 2 years there those spikes related to the ARRA funding. But otherwise, we've been on a downward trend for production in the 4% program since about 2003. Things just have kept declining. What's the result of that, and what's the current environment? There's been a production gap of about 2,800 to 3,000 units per year. About 17,000 households didn't receive affordable housing since 2008. That's the real math. That's the families impacted. The new financing sources that we've talked about today are great. That's wonderful, but they're not going to be sufficient to close the gaps in this production level. Justin touched a little bit on the billions of unused volume cap and tax credit authority. And that, of course, translates into hundreds of millions in untapped tax revenues, as well as jobs not fulfilled, okay, those production levels. So right to it, what do I think we could do today to somehow spur the production to some degree? Not that this would solve everything, but would be make a meaningful start. For one, having rents at 60% AMI in many markets in the state of California is a perfectly affordable and valuable rent for a low-income resident to have, especially get into the Bay Area and Los Angeles County. So one proposal is to eliminate that 10% requirement at 50% AMI if your 60% rents are 15% or more below market. This is a meaningful effect on increasing the supportable debt the project can bear. And as an example, we have a project we're doing in Southgate, California right now. It's 216 units. Southgate's a suburb of the Los Angeles area. That alone would have translated to about a $600,000 increase in proceeds on that particular project. Okay, so this is one example. This is something we're going to be advocating for, a change to the regulations with this provision. Secondly, modify the developer fee limits. Now, the value in this is enormous, and I'll explain why. But right now, there's about a $2.5 million fee cap on the existing program, the existing developer fees you can earn. And the proposal would be to allow 15% developer fee and eligible basis in project costs. Many of the big states like New York, Florida, Texas have this same provision. There is no cap on the fee itself. If there's a public policy concern about developers, quote, making too much money, which I get that and I understand it, then like HCD does, let's cap the cash portion of the fee, let's say at $2.5 million, maybe with an additional $10,000 per unit for every unit above 150, and then effectively defer the balance. The value in doing that is that you create eligible basis with that deferred fee, and that eligible basis is worth the tax credit equity in a pretty enormous proportion. And so on our Southgate project, again, that was about a $2.7 million impact had we implemented this provision on that project. So very, very valuable in stimulating additional equity, additional untapped federal resources free to the state of California that we can use for generating bond business. Okay? Third, this has been brought up a few times perhaps, but eliminate as a minimum construction standard the sort of greater than Title 24 standards. California already has one of the best energy codes in the country, if not the world. And every time we have to do something in addition to that, it adds cost to a project, makes it more financially feasible to obtain. Right now, if you're doing a tax-exempt bond project, Justin gets that call from a developer, and they say, well, you're going to have to build your building about 20% more efficient than the current code. They hear that, and they go, it's just a one more reason not to do a bond deal. Okay? So this isn't huge dollars in terms of, like, we estimate about $3,000 per unit on average is what it costs to exceed the current code by roughly 20%. But that's about a $650,000 item, and then if you back out the tax credit equity you would lose, it's about $350,000. So between these three items, these three changes, on our project alone, it's about a $3.6 million impact of additional funding or tax credit equity that could be available to our project or debt proceeds or whatever. But it's the accumulation of all of the little public policy goals that end up making these projects infeasible sometimes when you don't have the gap financing, the redevelopment, the other monies that we've relied on for years and years and years to go into these projects. And what's happened is we've lost all the money to do all this stuff, but the requirements and the promises and the scoring criteria and everything is still there. Hence, we have a massive production gap in the state of California right now, billions of bond cap going back from whence it came, and no execution, right? So those are three important SIDLAC TCAC changes. Next, I'll talk about just some other changes that I think would be valuable. Increasing points for new construction, that would provide additional incentives to maybe not have to do some of the other things in a point scoring system for SIDLAC. Award points for extended affordability, even if the round's not competitive. It's a tremendously valuable public policy goal to have 55-year affordability. Why not award it as an incentive to stimulate people to want to do it? Justin touched on this a little bit, but as long as we've got this surplus volume cap, let's really encourage those mixed income developers. You know, we don't really do that much mixed income projects, but help these guys come in here. At least you're going to get 20% of the units affordable. That's better than nothing affordable. That's better than 100% market rate. Let's do something in the regulations to really encourage those folks to come in and use the volume cap that we have. It's just getting wasted. No one's using anything. And then the other last point is just to allow those 100% and 60% AMI projects to earn the full points. So just, you know, these are just some. The three important ones I focused on. There's more detail to these, but this would be an area of focus, I would say. I'll talk about the state tax credit program a little bit. This would be something I think would be very valuable to stimulate production, the 4% program. I think that if we had, legislatively an additional $200 million in additional state tax credit authority prioritized for 4% projects, you'd really see a big kick to the program. There's no doubt about it. I would propose that we allow those 4% projects to earn the 130% boost for the federal credit, which they currently do not earn now other than special needs projects. And then change that credit percentage from roughly 13%, which is what it is today, to 30% like the 9% program. That would generate a huge amount of state tax credit equity for those projects, help close the gap, and make it a much more valuable credit as well. And then finally, the last more minor is to remove the minimum point score requirement for 4% plus state credit applications. Really encourage that volume to come up and help breed competition, help breed more public policy objectives if indeed the competition's up. And those changes alone in the state tax credit program, that probably represents, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,500 units of production a year just with that. Just with that change. That's sort of my guess at it. It could be more. So that's the state tax credit program. These are kind of some just other ideas to drive production. How do we get new units on the ground? How do we get them built? One thing to watch for is in 2016, if you're familiar with the difficult to develop areas, those are the areas that receive that 130% boost in the tax credits. HUD is changing the methodology, so all those county designations are going away, and they're going to a zip code methodology. That's going to disrupt a lot of things as you're looking at your pipeline of deals, and those changes are coming. I mean, it's near certainty that's going to happen. So now what you have to do when you apply for tax credits is you have to have a bond application pending, which locks you into a specific timeline to close that deal, start construction, et cetera. What I'm proposing, and this isn't like immediate but relevant, is that for that 2015 year, let all those developers that have projects that might lose their difficult to develop status in that county, let them submit for tax credits at the end of the year so that they can lock in their difficult to develop status for 2015, then submit the bond application for 2016 when they're ready. Okay? This will become very important. Nobody's really paying attention to this right now, but this is the looming disaster for developers that aren't watching this one. Shifting over to the 9% program, I might advocate for something that, let's say, maybe treat it like housing goals, where, for example, there's a certain bucket of new construction and a certain bucket of acquisition rehab. Maybe try to encourage and incentivize those acquisition rehab projects to the 4% program by kind of putting a cap on the amount of acquisition rehab projects that can get done under the 9% program. You know, make the 9% program your sort of production-oriented, public policy, you know, friendly type of program. That's one to consider. Maybe look at modifying the 9% tiebreaker to produce a more efficient use of the tax credits. Right now, the 9% tiebreaker really favors sort of throw as much soft money as you can at a project, maybe not necessarily to the benefit of the project, just for the sake of scoring and winning. So maybe incentivize efficiency a little bit more. And then, like the Veterans Program is doing now, the new funding there, try to prioritize those gap financing sources, like the Sustainable Communities Program that's coming, to incentivize 4% projects as a way to sort of stimulate that program further. So that's really ideas to drive production. And this is the question I'll leave you with. You know, this is certainly my perspective, and I think you might consider it to be yours. But, you know, we all want to develop affordable housing that's highly energy efficient, rents well below market. I mean, I love that as a developer, to have my rents 20, 30, 40, 50% below market. It's outstanding. I mean, no market risk. I love that. And we want to advance other public policy goals. I mean, at least I do. But really, we're leaving this money on the table, and are we willing to watch, you know, stand by and watch low-income citizens remain rent-burdened, overcrowded, substandard conditions, sit on waiting lists for years, no chance to live where they work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the things you all know, just so that we can have the most energy efficient, the deepest targeted, and have all these other public policy objectives that we do care about. In a competitive market where we're spending this money, outstanding. Let's advance as many public policy goals as we possibly can. But in a market where we're literally not producing the units, the public policy goals are not being fostered because we're not doing anything with the money, let's execute. Let's do something to actually stimulate production. So that's what I got for you. That's my thoughts on it. I'll turn it over back to you, Jeff. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Caleb. I'm going to break this panel kind of in half here because that was a lot of information that Caleb just went through. And if anybody wants to ask any questions on any of Caleb's ideas, I do want to say on the state credit, the thing to remember about the state credits, unlike a lot of these other programs that we've talked about earlier today, is you can do anything with the state credits. It isn't, you know, just veterans or just cap and trade requirements. I mean, you can use state credits really for any kind of deal, as long as you can put the rest of the sources obviously together to make it work. So it's definitely more user friendly in that regard. And also, it's all a matter of how everyone, and we all probably don't all have the same definition of what's the greatest public benefit. But I would argue in a environment where we're 2% vacancy, getting more production, and Caleb did a great job of going through all the slides on what we're lacking, and the problem's only going to get worse, not better, and if we don't do anything about it. Clearly, generating more housing in the state, whether it's to help people in need, whether it's to help the economy and jobs, whatever argument you want to use, is certainly a huge public benefit right now. So any questions for Caleb as he or Justin in terms of walking through with any of the information. Does anybody have any questions they want to ask there? God, you guys are smart. You got all of that. There's one.
Okay, well, here you go. So, you know, what do the policymakers respond to? They respond to the constituents, all you guys. And so volume matters. Volume matters. So the more that we as, like, I can't speak for CHC. I'm just speaking for me. But, of course, one move would be to advocate to CHC to take these positions and advocate for them publicly when the regulation changes are about to come out. And they're fixing to come out here soon. That's one. Secondly is, you know, write your own letters. Write your own correspondence. Come up with your own ideas. I mean, you know, these are just my ideas. You know, I'm sure you guys got some great ideas, too, how you might stimulate production, et cetera. So, but that's really what it comes down to. And then keep pushing it, right? Like any narrative, it takes time to develop. And the more it's talked about, the more it becomes apparent, the more, you know, people start accepting the narrative and executing with it. That's what I'd say.
Anybody else? Any other? The other comment I wanted to also reiterate Justin's comment on the 80-20 deals with the current requirement of the requiring if you go from 30 to 55 years and only having points and a competitive advantage, that's a challenge two ways. It unnecessarily, to me, makes the you can't get points where you otherwise could to make a bond deal, make the minimum threshold. But Justin's comment was the almost a different issue in that you're turning away 80-20 deals because they don't want the extended use. And in a lot of those cases, probably, as Justin said, they're doing 100% market or maybe it's 10% market if there's some kind of inclusionary requirement. Who knows? But it's probably not as many affordable units aren't getting built as a result of them not wanting to go that 55 years. And so that's a big thing, obviously, for the state and public benefit to try to encourage some of those 80-20 deals to get done. And then a lot of communities want mixed income anyway. Okay, with that, we've been focusing on more of the production end and new construction as part of our panel relative to what we can do better with the existing state programs. I want to now focus more on preserving the existing affordable stock and some of the challenges we have relative to either getting them done using bond deals, as we've talked, or just the state programs with HCD and CalHFA in particular. And as time goes on, I think also the expiring use tax credit deals is another big challenge, because a lot of these deals currently, when they hit the expiring use, are being sold to yield buyers and not being syndicated and redone as bond deals. And I think that's another challenge. And again, that goes back to using the 4% credit. So we want to focus more now on the preservation end of how we can improve our efforts in that area. So with that, I'm going to now turn it over to Jonathan Klein for his comments. Jonathan?
Thank you, Jeff, and thanks to CHC for pulling the panel together and for inviting us here. You know, I am a little bit of the odd man out here in that developers bring deals to Union Bank as a lender or investor, or to other institutions when those deals are really going to gel. So the deals that don't come together and the problems that they suffer are upstream issues that we tend to not see. So I was, you know, thinking on my way driving up here from the Bay Area today, it's a little bit like being asked to do an autopsy on a cadaver that you've never seen. But I do think that despite that perspective, there are some issues that come up again and again that are worth a little bit of your time and focus. In general, my comments fall into three buckets of places where I think we can all do a better job. The first is more coordination. The second is better politics. And the third is stepping out of silos. So let me talk first about better coordination. One of the beautiful things about this business, and Caleb touched on it, is the way that our interests are all aligned. You know, from our perspective at Union Bank, whether we're the lender or the investor, probably the single most important metric that we look at is the market rent advantage. To what extent are the rents below market rents? It lessens lease-up risk. It lessens occupancy risk. For those of you most concerned about serving the poorest people in your communities, you have the same interests. In terms of public officials who are supposed to be delivering affordable housing, they have the same interests. So in many ways, our interests are so aligned, and yet we oftentimes are working across purposes. You know, when we look, for example, at working with the state, with HCD and with some of the other state agencies, you know, it can be candidly both for us and our clients a somewhat frustrating experience. We typically might be the construction to perm lender or the equity investor, and we see deals that are ready to convert. We're ready to make that capital contribution to convert the deal to its permanent phase. We're ready to convert our loan to its permanent phase, and there are delays. And those delays sometimes can be many months. And what's particularly striking is that I think the projects that get the most hurt in that kind of a scenario are the projects where there's a special needs population. They're probably the projects that are the highest priority for the state, but oftentimes there are these delays in conversion that can result in higher interest costs, that can result in lost developer fee. So we oftentimes see ourselves failing to really find a way to work together. And one specific idea that I thought would merit some more discussion and focus would be looking at finding a way to do some sort of a common application to streamline the process. Just by way of illustration, at Union Bank and a lot of the other institutions that are represented here today, our whole due diligence process now is online. You know, if there's a preliminary title report, the bank wants it as the lender, Chase wants it as the investor, U.S. Bank wants it as the investor, the county wants it, the city wants it, the developer just posts it to one online website and everybody can go and get it. So streamlining the due diligence process by moving the submittals for these multiple different funding programs to an online system could really help streamline things. You know, my older kid is just starting her second year, sophomore year of college, and I remember when we went through the admissions gauntlet a few years ago, we had the common application. Some of you who are closer to having college-age kids are probably familiar with this. My kid applied to about 15 schools, and there was a common app, and, you know, there are probably hundreds, I don't know, thousands of schools that are very, very different colleges that all accept the common application. For whatever reason, here in California, you know, when you're working with different state agencies, you're having to go through an application process over and over and over again with the same information, the same data, the same submittals, time and again. It's, you know, I mean, here we are in the global center of technology and still struggling with these kinds of issues. So my point just is, you know, thinking about streamlining and efficiency and some technology solutions. Second point is better politics. We've come a long way in the last few years in terms of enhancing the political strength of the affordable housing community. And, you know, when Caleb was asked what's the answer, I think part of his answer was better politics. I'm struck by the fact that I don't think anybody's afraid of us. You know, clearly when the governor decided to demolish redevelopment, it doesn't seem as if he had a terribly large concern about what the impact would be on redevelopment. Clearly, when it came down to the realtors versus us, I think the realtors on 391 won hands down. And so I think being willing to sort of do what we need to do to strengthen the political clout of this field will make all of these other answers that Caleb and others put forth today much more likely to come to pass. And I'm not at all suggesting that tomorrow we would have the clout of the realtors, but we do have this enormous built-in constituency for what we do. You know, we all have heard the stories of the long wait lists, thousands of people who don't have housing, even the current residents. It would just seem to me as a matter of course, unless this was going to run afoul of some regulation, that when somebody is invited to, you know, or asks to be put on a wait list, that they also get some information about who their state assembly member is and who their state senator is, and that they go ahead and contact those folks and say, you know, I desperately need affordable housing and I'm on the wait list at all these different projects and I can't find it, and what are you doing about it? So I think we need to get more serious about how we approach this from a political standpoint, because that's going to facilitate a lot of the solutions to these other problems. Last point I just want to make is about stepping out of silos. You know, I think the work that was done around cap and trade is a great example of making common cause with people who care about climate change, with people who care about the environment, to help them realize that we have some shared interests. And clearly, you know, there's that old saying that, you know, strange bedfellows make for good politics. You know, the strongest coalitions are really the ones of unusual suspects. We have a client at Union Bank that's working closely with the city of Houston, because the city of Houston is very concerned, some of the hospitals in Houston are very concerned about some of their sky-high medical costs and what they call their frequent flyers. They're using the emergency rooms all the time. And they figured out, and I don't think this is gonna come as a surprise to anybody in this room, that a lot of those frequent flyers don't have an address. They don't have an address because they're homeless. And the hospitals in Houston have said, you know, we really need to find a way to get these people housed. You know, it's a good thing to do, it's nice, it's a good public benefit and so on, but it's gonna help us cut our costs. And so this particular developer is working closely with the city to help them identify those folks, who they are, and get them housed. The more and more we can break down the silos in which we work to make common cause with the people who don't care about affordable housing, but really ought to, and ultimately to make people across California realize that they have a vested interest in affordable housing, the more we're going to be able to solve a lot of these other very specific issues that are thwarting so much of the production today. Thank you.
Thanks, Jonathan. So we've heard from bond counsel's perspective, we've heard from the developer's perspective, we've heard from a lender investor's perspective. Now we want to hear from the state agency, one of the state agencies' perspective on this issue. And so I'm going to have Tia Bowman-Patterson come up here and talk to us about her perspective in terms of how we can improve our state programs to preserve the stock and what some of CalHFA's challenges are. Tia?
Thank you. It is like my 18th day on the job, so I haven't even been there three whole weeks. So thank you for having me. And the last speaker, I told him, you stole all my thunder. But I think that part of the problems with government is that we do often work in silos. And I want to just tell you briefly about the governor's reorganization plan, where he reorganized California Housing Finance Agency and the Housing and Community Development. And one of the reasons was to break down some of those silos so that we would have integrated policies and a single source of policy coming out, so that CalHFA could become a lender with a purpose. And so we do have a mission. And so how do we integrate some of our various funding mechanisms so that they all work together? And so those are exactly the things that we're working on now. We had the honor today to have our State of the Agency address, in which we had Susan Riggs, who is the Deputy Secretary, come and speak to us, and how housing kind of intersects everything that we all care about. But you don't necessarily think about that. And when you start talking about building coalitions, whether you're talking about prison reentry or health care or education or transportation or jobs, where you live intersects every single one of those things. And so breaking down the silos, not just in government, but breaking the silos of how we traditionally think of things and fund things and how we make things work together, because this is all works together. I told a story today during our annual State of the Agency, in which in this era of declining resources, in which we have the loss of federal resources, we have the loss of local government resources with the loss of redevelopment, and then we have state agencies who all do it in a variety of different ways, how do we work more in tandem with one another. And we have always kind of set up our piece of the pie, and I think Matt has probably heard me tell this story. But you can't continue to fight over the same piece of pie and be very territorial about what you do. It has to be about what we are all bringing to the table. And we all have something to bring to the table. And so we have to start utilizing our resources more efficiently so that we are able to work together. And so one of the revisiting the uniform application process, that is something that we'll be looking at, and we'll be working with our partners at HCD to revisit that uniform application process. Another thing that we're looking at is there are various pots of operating subsidies that the state offers. How do we develop an overall policy for operating subsidies? And so we then have a menu of options so that it's not on a project-by-project kind of basis, but you streamline some of those processes. So those are some of the things that we'll be looking at as well. Streamlining the processes, integrating policies so that we can be a lender with a purpose, and not working out counter purposes together, because oftentimes we will do that, and that's some of the challenges we have even had with some of our sister agencies. Well, we'll have a joint project, well, it have different time periods, different regulatory agreements. One will have a prepayment penalty and one will not. And so how do you start marrying all of those things together? And those are exactly the kind of things that we were hoping to get with this new reorganization and this realignment of our agencies. Some of the challenges we have at CalHFA is that we have been out of the business of financing new deals for quite some time now. Our traditional way of financing is gone. Issuing of tax-exempt bonds to finance a multifamily deal, that it's just not doable. So we're going to have to start thinking of ways to partner with the private sector and preservation of our existing portfolio. I know some of the things that we're looking at is the synthetic Ginnie Maes and some of the tools that will be offered by the federal government, but we will not be able to go this alone. It'll be all hands on deck, and it's going to take us thinking differently, working together and not working at cross purposes. And all of those policies that Caleb put on are all wonderful policies. But in an era of declining resources, are those still our priorities, or are we really trying to create more affordable housing? And how do we start prioritizing some of those public policy goals so that we can get what we're trying to get, which is a higher production of affordable housing? Thank you.
Thank you, Tia. And just to add on to the HCD stock or CalHFA stock or some of these expiring use tax credit deals, you have low interest rates, you have high credit prices, you probably have the best environment you're ever going to have to re-syndicate these deals. And so the extent that they're not getting done is arguably wasting a golden opportunity. God knows we've got plenty of bond allocation, because it's, I think we're all naive if we think these conditions are going to always be like they are today. So questions for anybody for any of our panelists? Yes.
Yeah, Marina will have all the slide presentations on the CHC website after the conference.
Yes, Kristen.
Yeah, Kristen said, for those who didn't hear, she said that 10%, eliminating the 10% of 50% AMI strategy will work in some markets but not in others. That's very true. I understand that personally as a rule developer as well, knowing that 60% is market or even above market potentially in some of the rule markets we operate. Nevertheless, that's kind of why I You know, there are some that might advocate the elimination of that policy, like just get rid of it altogether, 10% and 50%. That's why I kind of added that if the rents are 15% below market, in that market, then that would be the cause to eliminate that requirement. If they're not, then they're not, and then you're kind of, it sort of self-corrects that issue. Yeah, Kristen said that the idea to remove the $2.5 million cap on developer fees to get that additional basis would work in situations where you have the room in the eligible basis limits to actually let that developer fee go up. What I can say in my experience is with bond projects, they definitely incentivize some deeper income targeting anyways, and so sometimes you have limits that are 50, 60, 70, 80% above what the basis limits are, and you get those boosts for deeper targeting. So there might be sort of a balance there in those situations where you could, let's say, deeper target units, and the value of the additional equity that you're generating from the fee may overwhelm the loss in proceeds from the deeper targeting. So it actually, in those situations, I haven't looked at that, but that's a good point. It might have a de facto benefit of producing deeper targeting for the sake of getting the basis, which might be more valuable than the higher rent even. So, you know, but like, you know, it's something, right? And what we've seen is we rarely, in our projects, even with podiums, we rarely hit the limits on a 4% deal. We rarely do. But that might be, you know, I don't know why that is, but that's what our experience is. Kristen, oh, just to catch that last part, Kristen wanted to commend me on my good thinking to get all those points in.
Caleb and I, we just did a project in San Jose. Had we had that requirement, and it isn't just, by the way, the SIDLAC, a lot of the HCD or local agency requirements for their money limit the developer fee. You're just leaving free money on the table from the federal government. Like Justin said, it's like you're telling the Brinks truck, we don't want your money. Sure, small deals may not hit the limit. I get that, but a lot of deals are gonna go way above the limit, and it's kind of free money. I think we could have easily generated another $1 million on the deal we did. I haven't even run the numbers. That's $1 million less we would have either had to take from the city or the state that they could have put somewhere else. Any other questions for any of our panelists? With that, thank you, everybody.